Hey, folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. We've got two portions of the podcast, one old and one new. I'll start with the story behind the new one. Melanie Vammen is our first guest. You may remember she was on the show when she was a member of the Pandoras. They did a live set. Before that, she was in the Muffs. And the Muffs, of course, were fronted by Kim Shattuck. And Kim Shattuck was, boy, one of my all-time favorite guests, one of my favorite songwriters. If you're interested in the Muffs, by the way, check the archives because there's an interview with Kim on the phone. There's an interview with Kim where she's in the studio playing some acoustic songs. There's the live set by the Muffs. And there's an interview with Ronnie, their bass player, shortly, maybe a day or two after Kim passed away. It was very emotional. So if you're a Muffs fan, check the archives at WFMU.org/Michael. But anyway, so Melanie was posting these pictures, and after Kim passed away, they decided to make a little zine, a little booklet, and sell it to make to raise some money for ALS. And so when I saw a post about this online, I got in touch with Melanie and said, hey, why don't you come on the show, we'll promote the book. And she said, you know, the books are all sold out. It's sort of something folks had to pledge for ahead of time, which I don't know. I didn't see. I haven't been on social media that much lately. So I said, you know what? Why don't you come on the show anyway? Because I just want to, it's never wrong to sort of remember somebody like Kim. So unusual, such an amazing talent. So I don't know. It just seemed like the right time to remember Kim Shattuck and to shine a light on this amazing friendship, and you'll hear about it. It's really unusual what happened to Melanie and Kim as Melanie was hanging out with her in the final years or so. So that's coming up, and before that, we're going to hear from Shel Talmy. Now, Shel Talmy just passed away. Something kind of a little weird about this one is that when I was doing research for this, and by the way, this aired originally in December of 2008, and if you want to hear the whole show, the archive is at WFMU.org/Michael also, and I play a bunch of related songs to sort of get in the mood, but when I was doing the research for this one, I found a bunch of different birthdays listed for Shel Talmy, and so one of the very first questions I ask, you'll hear him, is what year were you born? And he answers that he was born in 1941. Now that he has passed away, it looks like he actually was born in 1937, so he was not being completely truthful. It's kind of a very rock star show businessy thing to do. He carved 4 years off his life in this interview. But we go way back here till, you know, from when he was an engineer working in California, and then he goes to LA and kind of bluffs his way into becoming one of the hugest producers of, you know, British Invasion and early 1960s music. So super interesting story. I think you'll enjoy it. And it's going to be Melanie Vammen and then Shel Talmy. Okay, there is the Muffs. And I think on the phone is Melanie Vammen. Melanie, are you there?
I'm here. Hello.
Hello and good morning. So let me fill the folks in on why we're talking today. You know, everybody on, I think everybody who listens to this show is a huge fan of Kim Shattuck's songwriting and the Muffs. And when she passed away, you know, folks were just devastated. For me, one of the all-time 10 favorite songwriters, period, Kim was. So when she was sick, you and her started looking at old photographs, and Kim said, hey, let's post a photo every Monday, and we'll call it Melanie and Kim Monday, and we'll both sort of comment on the photos. And that sort of started a thing that you guys did, and you have now sort of collected many of those photos in a zine called Melanie and Kim Monday. Is that sort of the right story?
For those that don't know, Kim passed away from ALS. It's a horrific, very aggressive disease. It affects everybody differently, though. With her, it was really aggressive, and she chose not to go public with it. And so we just started making new memories. Me and her pretty much spent a lifetime together. We were in Pandoras together, and then we formed the Muffs. And then when she became sick, we formed the Coolies with Palmyra Delran. So we just, you know, we knew we had to live for now, and we're just going to do what we do. And as odd as it sounds, we made a bunch more amusing memories, also sad ones, but we were there, part of each other's lives, like pretty much 24/7. And like you said, we were like good. We were always up to no good. We're shenanigans, all kinds of stuff. But well, Kim was sick. People don't know this. I do mention it in the fanzine book. She was paralyzed and she did not have use of her hands or anything really. And so anytime she posted on social media, she used a thing called a Toby Dynavox, and it's controlled by your eyes. And she was really incredibly good with it. She could do photos, edit photos, all kinds of stuff with it. And it spoke for her. It did any kind of interactions that she needed to be done. So we would often go through all of our old photo albums. We have tubs and all kinds of stuff like that through all our years together. We're sitting there one night and we're posting, and she's like, well, why don't we do something like every Monday? And then she named it Melanie and Kim Monday. So we started like every Monday, we would each pick out different photos and write a little story that went along with it. So that started in 2018, and we really didn't know how long Kim had. And so it was kind of, you know, living for the moment. And she would hit like kind of, it was sort of like a roller coaster, and she hit a plateau, and then she got more time. And, you know, she passed away after 2 years, but we had a while doing this together. And her last posts on social media were of me and her. And I told her, you know, when you're gone, I will continue this on. I will always continue this on. And I have.
I think it's such a great idea to put it sort of in a book form. And I know that this raised, you know, quite a bit of money for ALS. And if folks are interested, they should go to alsnetwork.org. If folks are kind of moved to donate in Kim's memory. I mean, looking at the pictures and reading the captions, I mean, it looked like, first of all, your friendship was really just a riot, like, you know, just super, super duper fun. And I think you say in the zine that you played your very first gig, her very first gig ever on a stage was with you, and her very last live performance was also with you. So how old were you two when you guys met?
Well, she was older than me. I was in my teens, and I met her in a store, and we were looking for a bass player. And it just so happened, I knew her boyfriend, and he said she played bass, and she did not. And so I called her up, and she came and she tried out. And instantly, I've never had a friendship like this ever. Instantly, her and I, we were connected. It's like we went out that night, and we were like, wow, we're like best friends already. We're meant to be. And it just like right away, our friendship started, and we're just really funny. I mean, she's the funniest person I know in my life, and me and her together were just so funny. And while she was going through all of this, we still did a lot of funny stuff. A lot of stuff people would be surprised that we had going on.
She was really a goofball, and she was really a unique person. I mean, her point of view of life was unlike anybody I ever hung around with. So, you know, I'm looking at this and I'm hearing your stories about how sick she was and how she persevered during the worst of it, you know, even close to the end. And I think it would be real hard to do what you did, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it, well, I don't know. How hard was it to do?
I can tell everybody here, me and Kim, we had each other. We were each other's best friends in the whole wide world. I'll never have a friend like her again. And same for her, you know? You know, we had other friends, but different. Those were different friendships. This, like, me and her were just this incredible connection, like we're supposed to be. So it was hard, but, you know, we've lived our whole lives together, you know, through happy and sad. We've been through a lot of things. And in the end, we just lived every single day, and I am a true believer in that. It's like, you just do your thing. You don't worry. You don't be afraid. Don't fear the things. Live your life, because you're going to miss out on what could be. And that's the way me and her always were, completely real people. You know, there's no room for like a bunch of like crap, you know. Just say how you feel about people. Tell people how you feel about them. And do the things that you want to do. Try it. And so we just, every day, like I slept over pretty much every night, and we would like, okay, what are we going to do today? And we'd make a plan and we'd work on new music for our bands, or we'd be like, oh, let's watch movies. Or there were a couple times we went out, we went to Dodger game, and I'm like, don't you think someone might recognize us? And at this point she was, you know, and they didn't recognize us, because she goes, no one would think of her as, she called herself Gimpy Me, and she was paralyzed, and she was in like a wheelchair that went all the way back, like a chair, you know, like a recliner chair. Like, you wouldn't exactly know, and she didn't exactly look, you know, like her. So she was able to do a few things like that, not often, but you know, that just lit her up, being able to see the Dodgers play.
It blew me away that she was still writing songs and making dirty jokes and stuff, you know, with just her eyes, that she never stopped being creative to the end. I was going to ask you if this whole experience changed your life, you know, the way you live your life today, but it's obvious that it does. So let's talk about her as a songwriter. To me, she, like I said earlier, she's just one of my favorite songwriters. Just, you know, the energy she brings and the melodies and the subject matter and just the energy, you know, it's just really just some of my, do you know where that came from? Was it just magic? Did you watch her write songs? What can you tell us?
So when I met her, she had gone to college a little bit for photography, and she had been playing guitar some and writing tunes, you know, like had a garage band, just like literally in the garage with her boyfriend. And it was all new to her. You know, like, she learned how to play bass when she joined the Pandoras, just like I had when I joined the Pandoras with my keyboard, basically the same thing, and I was in high school. So, you know, she kept writing songs. She always loved the Beatles, the Kinks, Peter Noon, all like kind of like British power pop type of 60s stuff. And she just had a great sense of melody. She used to sing in choir when she was young with her family. And so they all sang. So she really knew melody. Like, when she got into Pandoras, she was singing a lot of the harmonies with Karen and with Paula. And, you know, she just kept writing, playing guitar. And then she got a four track, and then she started making demos. And later on in the end of the Pandoras is when her and I, we didn't want to do that anymore. It was, you know, it wasn't really our style anymore. It had become such heavy rock, and we wanted to do our own thing, our creations, our thing. So she, you know, started pulling out the songs that she had been writing, and we started jamming. And then, I wrote a song with her as well. And that's kind of like how that all started. She kept doing it. And the thing is, she wrote about, like Kim did her own thing. Kim had her own way of thinking, and she's going to tell you that. And it's not like these real sweet love songs or anything like that. It's more like, you know, I don't like you, things like that, or all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
Beautiful, amazing melodies with all like these cool minor chords, and, you know, no poser style at all, or copying anybody, her own musical style.
Yeah.
And that's really, like, you know, where it started from.
Yeah, it really seems like she didn't have patience for anything she didn't like or respect, you know. That's kind of part of
that's true. Of
her thing. Yeah.
Yeah. You put that perfectly. That's true. And she would tell you to your face.
Right. I also want to point out that WFMU family member Sherry Locker did the layout and design of the zine. Again, it's called Melanie and Kim Monday, and you're still active on Facebook, and folks can look back and see all that stuff. And they can donate to the ALSnetwork.org in Kim's memory, if they like. Let's hear a related song. You want to hear a Coolies song? You want to hear a Muff song? What do you want?
Why don't we do a Coolies song? Because we also, while she was sick, you know, we recorded and put out an EP, and all the money went to ALS, 100% of it, just like the fanzine book that I just put out. And you know, that was just shy of $9,000 raised for ALS. So So, yeah, I think the Coolies would be awesome.
All right, Melanie Vaman, thanks so much. It's just such an amazing story, and I don't know. I just was so moved by the whole just reading the zine and just hearing about your friendship and just so unique and beautiful. So, and I think your message is great that we should live life. It's so hard to do sometimes, but you're right. We need to every day live life to the fullest.
Absolutely. That's what you got to do, people. Just do it. Make music. Do whatever it is that you feel a passion for. Follow your passion. And it's okay if things don't work out. You try other things. Just, like, be you. Be real. Say how you feel. And, you know, and I also want to say thank you to, like, all the people, Noah, Jen, and Sherry at Music Archives, the ones that approached me to put out this fanzine book. And I'm really super proud of it, and they did an amazing job.
Yeah, Noah, also of FMU family, yeah.
Yes, absolutely, they are. And I also want to say thank you to all of you that have donated, that bought the fanzine book, also donated extra money, and all the messages I've received. It's just an honor, you know, to make a difference in somebody's life, be a part of this, and hear, you know, your feelings, or people that, you know, have a loved one dying of ALS. People write me about that too. So I just want to, like, tell you all I love you.
And, you know, we'll have Kim's music forever. That's kind of one of the amazing parts of the story is that, yeah, her music will be here forever. All right, Melanie, thanks so much. Let's hear the Coolies now.
Thank you. Bye, Michael.
Yeah, the Easy Beats and Friday on My Mind. That's a song I never, ever get tired of hearing. It's just one of those, you know, it's greater than the sum of its parts somehow. Produced, of course, by Mr. Shel Talmy, who joins us on the telephone. Shel, welcome to WFMU. How are you?
Thank you, Michael. How are you?
I'm fantastic. I just came back from a week in Mexico, so.
Oh, okay. Well, in that case, you should be in good shape.
Yeah, I'm relaxed and tan. Yeah, I'm great. You know, what a great record that is. Answer this for me. What does a record producer do? I think it's a hard question to answer because, A, some of them do nothing and some of them do a lot and every variation in between. What makes a good record producer?
Okay, well, from my point of view, my definition is somebody who is totally hands-on, which is the way I've always tried to do this, is I think probably the easiest way to explain it is a kind of a combination of what you do for what a film director would do if he did everything but both produce and direct at the same time. So, in other words, I'd find the artist, choose the material, do the arrangements, sit in the studio, obviously. I started out as an engineer, get the sound, and get everything together with the rest of the song, and then finally finish up with the mix, which is the most important part, to put it all together, just like editing a film is.
Hmm. You were born, I've read, a few different dates. Can you tell me the exact date?
Yeah, 1941.
And just around Chicago, is that right?
Chicago, that's right.
And when did you sort of first become aware of music? When did you hear music? Were your folks musical?
No, not at all. I think I just I grew up liking music. We were in a place with a lot of radio stations, and I always liked listening to what I was hearing, which, you know, at the time was, when I was a small kid, was, you know, big bands and all that kind of stuff. And the first, I guess, well, I suppose it'd now be called R&B, record that really turned me on was G by the Crows. And from that point on, I sort of started listening to everything, and especially things that were, you know, more rhythmic and different from what the big bands were doing, albeit that I'm still a big fan of, you know, that kind of music.
Yeah, I mean, to be born in 41, you sort of got to be just the right age to sort of hear rock and roll develop from something never heard on the radio to something that took over popular entertainment. It's kind of a great time to be born.
Well, it's unless, of course, you realize what age you are at the moment. Yeah, it was fun. It was a good transition period because it certainly went from that through, well, early blues and R&B and early, I guess, probably now they call it soul. Like they didn't call it that then. It was great, yeah.
You wouldn't want to be a 14-year-old now, though, would you?
I didn't want to be a 14-year-old then.
At age 13, you appeared regularly on the television show Quiz Kids out of Chicago.
Right.
A lot of smart youngsters who went on to do great things went through that television show, right?
I guess a few of them did, certainly. I think probably the most famous one, I believe, is Dr. Watson of Watson and Crick, who did the DNA, not the DNA, the helix, all that kind of stuff.
Was that a fun experience? Was that torture? Was that something you were?
No, actually, it was. It what it did for me was convince me that I wanted to be in showbiz in some aspect of it, and. I loved it. I thought it was a really fun thing to do.
You moved to Los Angeles around age 15 and you start working as a page at a television station, right?
Yeah.
With your whole family moves there?
Yeah. Oh, yes. I certainly didn't go by myself. At 15, I was moved there.
And eventually you get a job working at Conway Studios as an assistant engineer, right?
Correct.
So what year is that?
That was 1960, I think.
And what kind of work were they doing?
Oh, there was the guy who owned the studios, who was an English guy named Phil Yend, was doing what then was rock or blues or whatever, whatever came through. He had a very nice studio. He had been an engineer in London and had a very good reputation, a super guy, and trained me as an engineer. I mean, at that point, we're talking about, pretty primitive, pretty basic compared to what's available today.
Was it a three-track?
It was a three-track, right? And the console was rotary pots on the board rather than sliders, a board that you can, a patch board that you could patch anything to, and so it took me all of like 3 days to learn all this stuff. After the third day, talk about being, tossed into the deep end. I did my first solo session, which I sweated through, but it was fun.
And so, what was it? Was a day typically like do three or four 3-hour sessions, and you never knew who was coming in?
Well, we knew who was coming in, obviously, because people booked. But but they were 3-hour sessions, pretty much. Yeah.
And you worked on Marquette, Surfer Stomp, Billy Joe and the Checkmates, Percolator, just all kinds of hit records, basically.
Yeah, we did a lot of stuff there. We did a lot of very good things. There were a lot of very good people coming through there, musician wise, who became well known. As session guys, and lasted for years and years.
All those Wrecking Crew guys, yeah. Well, how amazing were they?
Oh, they were terrific musicians. Yeah, it set me up from that point on to really like great musicians because you could really tell the difference. And one of the things I've always enjoyed is being with really terrific musicians, and I get on with them very well.
I'm sure they make the job a lot easier as well.
It makes it all worthwhile, yes.
Let me ask you just a technical question. When you're recording in those days on the three-track, something like Marquette Surfer Stomp, how many drums, how many mics are on the drums?
Well, what happened was, let me start from the beginning here. At that point in time, people were putting maybe 4 or 5 mics on drums. Phil and I decided that we were going to see if we could do better things with isolation, with more mics. And so we worked out a way to do a dozen mics in the drums without them phasing. And so that's what we wound up doing. And in fact, I took that with me to London when I finally went, and they were only using 4 mics, and They said, you can't do 12 mics and a drum. I said, well, just listen. So, you know, 3 months later, everybody's using a dozen mics and the drums.
So, yeah, after a couple of years at Conway Studios in LA, you moved to England just because you, what was the idea? You just thought,
I didn't actually move to England. I went on a trip to England. I was 21. I decided that life was passing me by. And I really had to see Europe before the end. And I'd intended to go for about, you know, 5-6 weeks. I wanted to be in London, you know, 3-4 weeks, and then do, like, the continental thing and come back. And, in fact, I had a deal waiting for me back in L.A. as a producer, which had been offered to me right before I left. And I thought when I got to England, if I possibly could, you know, work for a couple of 3 weeks and earn some bread, that would be nice because I didn't have any. And so I basically, I took some precautions before going. I got as many names as I could from people I knew here, of people to see, and my friend Nick Vinay, who was at Capitol at the time as an A&R guy and was doing some great stuff, said, here, you know, take my demos and tell them you did them, because I didn't really have anything. So I said, fine. And when I walked in to Decca, I played the Beach Boys and Lou Rawls, and they said, thank God you arrived, you start today. So,
and did they ever find out that that wasn't your
work? Yeah, eventually. But being British gentlemen, they never really mentioned it, and I never really mentioned it, but of course they knew.
Fair enough. The deal worked out for her. So right away you just started producing. Do you think the fact that you were American, that there was some sort of cachet or sort of mystery behind your...
Without question, excuse me, and the fact that I... The guy I was working for, Dick Rowe, was very pro-American and very plugged into what was going on in the States. So it made life easier. I would say there was a great cachet in being American at the time, yes.
You produce a big hit with The Bachelors, and then so you sort of got off on a real good foot, and then pretty quickly you find the Kinks, right?
Well, the transition between that and the Kinks was that I then brought in both Manfred Mann and Georgie Fame into Decca, and they turned them both down on me, and I was, by the way, probably the first independent producer in England, and getting royalties, which was not something that the other producers were doing. They were getting just a weekly salary.
They were just staff guys.
They were staff guys, and I said, you know, being brash as hell and having nothing to lose, because I didn't have anything, I said, oh, by the way, Dick, I get royalties. So so at that point, when they turned on, I thought, you know, maybe it's time for me to go spread out and see where else I can find here. So I started looking up at the Kinks. I was just in the right place at the right time when one of the managers walked in with a demo that I liked, and I took him into Pi, because at that time I was thought that going back to Decca wasn't probably the right thing to do.
The Kinks, one of the most amazing bands ever, one of the great songwriters of all time, and the records are played continuously even today, you know, here we are a million years later. It's really sort of the bedrock of sort of the album, you know, rock format is still those great early Kinks records. I mean, did you guys know when you were doing it that this would be around, or was it...
Well, I think it became apparent fairly early on that... Ray Davis was one of the great songwriters of that time. Certainly, a great interpreter of English sounding or English songs, English themed songs. He was almost a poet in a way. And it was apparent, certainly after You Really Got Me, that when he kept coming up with things that here was, you know, something to really hold on to that probably would last, and you know, fortunately they have.
It seems like, yeah, he was a... There was sort of this explosion of post-war teenagers, and guys like Ray Davis were experiencing that change of English society. Was he doing it consciously, or was it...
I think what happened at the time was that all the post-war teens in England were listening to American blues and what passed for rock and roll and all that kind of stuff, and there was just a kind of a spontaneous renaissance. If you could figure out why this happens, you could probably bottle it and make a fortune. But there's no rhyme or reason for it. It happened. Hmm. All of a sudden, from nothing, a whole bunch of really terrific musicians and songwriters sprung up, and I was in the right place at the right time again. It was great.
Yeah. So how quickly were those early Kinks records made? How long to do a song, generally speaking?
We'd do at least three tracks, probably four tracks in a three-hour session. And
with a lot of overdubbing, or
no, it's just the basic tracks. But we were recording live, of course. So we're talking about the entire band plus a vocal, and I'll sometimes skip the vocal.
Hmm.
With the overdubbing and everything, I know we're talking probably, I don't know, 5 or 6 hours per song, probably not more than that.
There's an idea that Jimmy Page plays every instrument on and every early Kinks record. What's the actual truth?
Well, for about the 5,000th time, Jimmy Page did not play solo on You Really Got Me. Dave Davis did. Jimmy Page was my anchor in terms of somebody I could depend on to play guitar if I needed it. And in fact, the first Kinks album, he played rhythm guitar because Ray didn't want to do that and sing at the same time. He didn't feel he could do a good job if he was playing guitar. So I said, fine. So I got Ray Davis and, I got Jimmy. And Ray concentrated on singing, so which worked out fine.
Ray sang live, Jimmy played the rhythm guitar, and Dave played those fantastic solos that, to me, don't sound anything like Jimmy Page. They're pure Dave Davies. Yeah.
They're absolutely. And Dave, I'd say, I always thought was a very underrated guitarist. He's a damn good guitarist.
Oh, he's great, yeah. Bobby Graham plays drums on some Kinks records?
He played on all the original On You Really Got Me and on the first album, yes.
And that was...
They didn't have a drummer at the time.
Mick Avery just joining the band, and you just thought you'd go with the pro.
I'm sorry?
Mick Avery just...
Mick Avery wasn't added till afterwards.
Gotcha.
So I had the pro there because they didn't have a drummer.
Does Clem Cattini play on any Kinks records that you worked on?
No.
Is the Kinks 1967 record Live at Kelvin Hall, is it live? Did you work on that record?
No, I did not.
Okay. I want to see if it's really live or not. I'll get to the bottom of it eventually. The Kinks, are you still in touch with them? Is there any connection?
Not really, no.
And so you got a percentage of those royalties. Do you think you've been fairly compensated?
That's a whole other story. I mean, as far as the Kinks are concerned, and, you know, whatever, yes, there was somebody eventually who interposed himself between me and my royalties. That's a whole other saga, which I don't think we're going to go into.
That's fine. Can you what percentage for your whole lifetime in the music industry, what percentage of money that's owed to you, money that you actually have a contractual obligation to get, do you think you've been paid?
Well, it depends on the artist. I mean, you know.
Overall,
maybe 40 or 50%.
Okay, soon after the Kinks, you find The Who, and apparently they really wanted to work with you. They found you.
They did, yes.
And there's, you know, as I was listening to all of this music that you produce around the time, there's definitely a sonic similarity to a lot of it. It's definitely the Shel Talmy sound.
Well, it's my sound, I guess. That's, you know, what I'm hearing, and certainly the rhythm part, which I was very concentrated on getting the way I wanted to hear it, became apparently some kind of signature for, you know, bass and drums. And I spent a lot of time getting drum sounds before I even got to England. And I spent a lot of time with guitars and bass and getting them isolated so that, you know, the real sounds could come through. And then I spent a lot of time with them making all kinds of wild and weird sounds, you know. So, I guess if there's a signature, there's probably some kind of signature there that makes it, you know, sound kind of the same, I guess.
And did bands like the Kinks ever say, hey, don't make The Who sound too much like us?
No, I never heard that.
And what was it like working with these guys? A totally different kettle of fish than the Kinks.
Entirely, yeah. Townsend, again, I how fortunate was I had two of the great writers of all time for rock and roll, you know, at the same time.
Yeah, it's mind-blowing.
It made life a lot easier, yes. Pete was great. I'm still friendly with Pete. We speak, you know, not often, but very occasionally. At the time, he had all the attitude that a rock and roller is supposed to have, as did everybody.
And what about Keith Moon?
Keith Moon, actually, I got on best with Keith Moon out of everybody in the band.
Was he a sweet guy?
He is a very nice guy. From my point of view, yes. I never saw any of the stuff he was alleged to have done.
And as a producer...
I'm sorry.
That's okay. As a producer, he drums in a style that's just from a different planet. At first, did that throw you? Did you ever try to tame the wild beast?
I thought he was the greatest rock and roll drummer of all time. I still do.
Yeah, he's amazing.
He just had it. And it was an absolute pleasure recording him. When he got back of all of my mic setup, and I said, Keith, do me a favor. These mics are expensive. Don't hit them. You come within a millimeter. He said, no problem, you know. And he was great. He never missed a beat, never did anything except play like he was supposed to.
Yeah, great. There's a story that recording My Generation, John Entwistle kept breaking strings on his bass, and he couldn't find replacement strings, and he had to go buy new Dan Electro basses. Is that a true story?
Not as far as I'm concerned,
it's,
no.
It's in the liner notes, yeah.
He may have broken one string during the session, but that was about it.
Okay.
He played harder than anybody, yes.
Mm. You worked with David Bowie. We heard some Manish Boys cuts. Great stuff there. We heard the Easy Beats. They were from Australia. They were living in England. And how did you find them?
They actually found me. They came they had come to England, as I know the story, with their then manager, and he did some sides with them for EMI, I guess, and they rejected him, so they came and found me, and I liked what I heard, but I didn't like the material a whole lot, so I used to get together with them and tell them what I thought should, you know, they should be doing and how they should be doing it. And I'd come back and play me stuff once a week until I heard Friday in My Mind. I said, that's the one we're going to do. So.
And when you hear a song like Friday in My Mind sort of blasting out of the speakers, you know, after the basic tracks are done, does everybody know at that point?
That was one of the few, I think, was a total natural. Yeah, I think we all knew that was going to be it.
Yeah, and just one of those songs covered by a million bands for eternity. Mm-hmm. You had huge hits with Chad and Jeremy. Again, a totally different sound there. Nashville Teens, The Fortunes, Nicky Hopkins, and then back to Manfred Mann again. Had some big hits.
Right. Well, after Paul Jones left them, they then came back to me with Mike Dabo and... He said, can you now do them? Which, of course, I was independent, so I could. And because they were worried they were not going to ever have another hit after Paul left. But we managed it, so.
Yeah. The Rockin' Vickers had a few hit stuff. Was Lemmy from Motorhead in the band at the time you worked with
them? Yes, he was, yeah.
And was he just a normal pop-making guy?
Yeah, he was. He was a good guy.
Yeah.
I like the Rockin' Vickers a lot, and I've always regretted that they didn't get bigger than they were. I think they should have.
Yeah, they had some great... There's a ton of English bands around that time whose records never even really were released in the States. You know, there's just tons of them. Tell me about the Beatles' influence at this time. I mean, was it something that was like a bar that was set for producers like you, or was it something just another band?
As far as we were concerned, all that the Beatles did was pretty much pave the way for the rest of the bands to have a market in America and, you know, in other parts of the world.
No, I don't think anybody consciously tried to emulate a Beatles sound.
We heard from The Creation earlier. Those records to me sound totally fantastic. A great band, again, a band really sort of unknown in the U.S. Is it hard to make loud records sound good, particularly?
Interesting question. Yeah, probably it is. There's certainly some science attached to making a loud record sound good so that it doesn't destroy everybody's eardrums and it doesn't distort. The Creation, by the way, are my absolute number one major regret, because they should have been superstars.
And,
I had a huge deal for them after they had their number ones in England for America, and they broke up. I just could not keep them together.
Yeah, there is one. They're one of those bands that were sort of an influence on a lot of people, but not necessarily, you know, you don't really hear their songs on the radio.
Yeah, well, you don't hear enough of them. That's true. They have become kind of a cult band in America. And of course, they were. They had a couple of their songs in films, and you know they've been in commercials, and so a lot more people know them now than used to.
It just seems like it's hard to make records sound powerful and loud, and you know there's so many different approaches to that than there are for softer sounding music.
Things that I worked on with Bill or separately on trying to get a louder apparent sound without distorting, and
yeah.
I think we sort of managed it.
Let me remind folks, we're talking to Shel Talmy, record producer, and lots of other things, which we'll find out. The 60s sort of changed, and the whole style of pop music changed. You started working with the Pentangle, Roy Harper, Lee Hazelwood eventually in 1970. What was he like?
Oh, Lee is great. Great guy. We were very good friends. We both had the same lawyer, which is how I met Lee. And when he wanted to do his 40th birthday record, he asked me to do it. So I said, "Yeah, I'd be delighted. It'd be great fun."
Yeah, what a creative nut that guy was. Yeah. So around 71 or so, you sort of decide not to make music anymore.
I think I probably got bored. You know, I started doing lots of other things, and I mean, in retrospect, maybe I shouldn't have done, but I did. I did lots of other stuff, and I kind of eased off a lot. And
was it the music that was changing that bored you, or you just had done it?
Yeah, maybe partially. As it happened, I like 70s music a lot. And I probably should have done more of it, but I got involved in other things. I got involved in book publishing. And
you wrote some mystery novels. Can folks get those still?
Yeah, they're still available, probably via Amazon or somewhere like that.
And you worked for the RAND Corporation, nonprofit think tank, does military sort of consulting, right?
Yeah, they do consulting of all kinds of stuff.
That's kind of a big jump from making, you know, records with Keith Moon, or is it?
Well, there was a lot of people who say it was no jump at all. it was, I was there on call for various things I wanted to do. And
technology related.
I didn't do a whole lot for them.
Okay. You did sort of come back to music, eventually made some records, made a record with The Damned, a few other folks. And
well, The Damned was kind of an experiment in the fact that I really did not like punk rock. But I thought, to be fair, I should try and do one before I totally condemned it. So I did The Damned, which was certainly an experience.
It's a great sounding record, you know.
Yeah, well, I believe it's. I'm told that a lot of those records are going for big money now, which is interesting. It was fun. I'm glad I did it. I'm glad I didn't do any more of it.
Yeah. So, if folks wanted you to produce a record, are you into that? Doing that now?
Yeah. excuse me. Yes. I would be happy to do a record with the proviso that what was presented was
my idea of music and good material. This has been a problem. I do get stuff submitted to me, and I'm afraid I haven't really heard much that has made me want to go spend a lot of time in the studio. Not saying that it isn't good, but it just doesn't turn me on. If there were, if I got a band that played music and had some good songs, which is I still believe to be 75% of what makes a hit record. Maybe not today, but that's the way it used to be. And of course I do it. Yeah, it'd be great fun to do it.
So what else are you doing all day?
What? Not as much as I should. I'm actually I'm called on to listen to various things that they. I guess you'd call me a consultant on occasion, and I am actually doing lots of other stuff not connected with music. So
I wanted to ask you, as a producer, as somebody who worked on these great records, 30 years later, some of them coming out on CD for the first time, do you ever listen to a CD and say this just is, they got it wrong in the remastering?
Yeah, occasionally I will. Of course, I did the redone Who thing, so.
Right. And those sound fantastic, and lots of alternate takes and mixes and things.
Right, yeah, we did all that, and I would have liked, again, we're on a very big budget, I'd like to have taken a bit more time with it, because I think I could have done it slightly better. In general, I was pleased with it.
Yeah, let me remind folks, it's WFMU East Orange, WXHG Mount Hope, and WFMU.org. Shel Talmy is our guest today. All right, I have got the song You Really Got Me queued up in the CD player to get us out of here. Is there anything else folks need to know about what you're up to or what you've done?
I think you probably covered it pretty well. Yes, I am available. Anybody wants to contact me, my website is shelltalmy.com, and if you got a great band, and with the provisos I said, you got them there. The other thing is, you really got to have a deal now. I don't want to do anything on spec anymore. I don't go out and sell bands to labels anymore, because it just doesn't happen. So yeah. If you have a deal, I'm very interested.
You've had an incredibly interesting career, and the number of hit records you had is an incredibly high percentage, Most would be lucky to have...
Well, I don't mean to interrupt you. I'm thinking that when I've been asked that before, or it's been broached before, I kind of like to give the analogy of a record producer is kind of like a star baseball player. He's got a 300 hitter. That means he's failed 7 times out of 10. That's a hell of a percentage if you get that as a producer.
Yeah. But, I mean, even there's lots of great producers who have a much lower batting average than you. Let's put it that way. But, yes, 300 is fabulous in any weird business like this. All right, you've really got me. Tell me what we need to know about this recording, this record, this song. When's the last time you heard it sort of driving to the Ralph's supermarket? Or?
Well, they keep playing it, so I mean, whatever I turn on, whether it's AM or FM or satellite radio, it's there a lot, so I hear a lot. And still one of my favorites. I still like it a lot. I think it's got everything that a rock hit should have. Great riffs and great solo, and it's one of those things that we all thought, by the way, was when we finished doing it. So
yeah. Well, let's hear it now. Shel Talmy, thanks so much for getting up early and chatting with us.
Thank you, Michael.
side.